delighted to welcome you all to this annual lecture of LSE's Equity, Diversity and Inclusion Task Force, which is a task force that was set up a year ago to work on issues of equality and diversity within LSE for students and for people working here. I'm Anne Phillips. I'm from the Government Department, and I'll be chairing this lecture, and it's my very great pleasure to chair this lecture by Laura Bates, who I'm sure is known to many of you, probably most of you, as the founder of the Everyday Sexism Project, which has been enormously successful in enabling, I think it's now over 100,000 women from countries across the world to share their stories of experiences of everyday sexism. And I think, I think it's especially important the everydayness of it. I mean, the kind of sexism that we're told to sort of to see as just sort of part of the everyday, normal, taken for granted part of our lives, and just to shrug off as though it's insignificant. And I think in enabling people to really take on the seriousness of some of that sexism, I think Laura Bates and the people she's worked with on this have done an enormous service. Laura has written two books, one called Everyday Sexism and a second one called Girl Up. I think they're both available for sale outside, and at the end of the lecture, Laura will be available to sign books. For those Twitter users among you, the hashtag for this event is at LSE Laura Bates. Yes, it's on the it's on that there. We will be recording the event, so with luck there will be a podcast available on the website sometime later in the week. Basically, the program is that Laura will speak for 45 to 50 minutes, where we should have a good half hour for discussion. And then, as I say, at the end of it, those of you who want to buy the book and sort of have a further chat with Laura as she signs it, then that's also possible. So can I now just ask you to join with me in welcoming Laura Bates to this annual lecture.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me. It's really great to be here. Can everybody hear me okay? Brilliant. Just wave at the back if I'm quiet at some point and you can't hear me. So I've been asked to talk tonight particularly about the situation of gender equality, gender inequality, as it pertains particularly to women in the workplace and to university campuses in the UK. And I'm going to come on to focus on those two topics particularly. But in order to kind of give you the wider context to where I'm coming from and to explain a little bit about my work and how I come to be here, I want to start with a slightly more zoomed out picture. I want to start by explaining a little bit more about the Everyday Sexism Project and how it came about and what some of its findings have been, because these things are so closely interlinked that it isn't really possible to talk about one without the other. So I set up the Everyday Sexism Project in 2012, and for me it was after a particularly bad week during which I'd had a number of experiences that just happened to have occurred within a very short space of time. So I was walking home one day when a man followed me all the way home, quite aggressively sexually propositioning me, refusing to take no for an answer, following me to see where I lived. And a few nights later, I was on the way home on the bus quite late at night on the phone to my mum, and the man next to me started groping me and put his hand between my legs. So I stood up and moved away from him, and because I was on the phone, I said out loud what perhaps I wouldn't have felt able to say otherwise. I said quite loudly, "I'm on the bus, and this man just groped me." And everybody on the bus looked away. They looked out of the window, they looked down at their phones. They sent such a powerful message to me of, why are you bringing this up? This is your thing to deal with. Don't bring this into our public space. But also to the man groping women he didn't know on the bus, you carry on. because nobody will challenge you, because this is socially acceptable. Even when it is loudly said what's happening and what you've done, this is something that we will all turn a blind eye to. And a few days later, I was walking down the street, and there was some scaffolding being unloaded off the back of a truck. And as I walked past within a metre of the men working on this truck, one of them turned to the other and said, "Look at the tits on that." As if almost they'd passed a tree and he commented on it. There was no sense of embarrassment or awkwardness, no sense that there was any fear of my saying anything back. It was just completely normalised. And at the end of this week, I was thinking about these events which had happened and what a terrible week it had been. And what suddenly struck me was that if they hadn't all happened within the same week, I never would have thought twice about any one of those incidents in isolation, because it was normal. It made me recall similar incidents that had happened over the months and years that I'd never mentioned to anybody, never reported, never felt able really to protest, because it was just normal. It was part of being a woman. And it made me start talking to other women and girls and just asking them about their own experiences. I think many of us have that automatic thought of, well, perhaps I'm unlucky, or perhaps I've been doing something wrong, or perhaps I live in an area where this is particularly happening. And so I just started asking, have you ever experienced anything like this? And I thought that perhaps if I asked enough women, maybe every now and then I'd meet one, perhaps one in every five or six I asked, who would say, yes, this once happened to me. This is my story. This is my one experience that happened a few years ago, or this was a bad job I once had. And it wasn't like that at all. It was every woman I spoke to. And it wasn't one experience from a few years ago. It was, on my way to meet you today, this just happened. Or people who said that they were in workplaces where their male colleagues would go to strip clubs at lunchtime and take clients there so they would miss out on those deals. Or women who worked in offices where their male colleagues would print out photographs of women who were coming in for interviews and hold them up and give them ratings out of 10 across the office before they came in. And many of them made a point of saying to me, until you ask the question, I've never told anyone any of these stories because they're normal. Or I wouldn't be able to say anything or to challenge this because everybody laughs along, because it's just banter, because it's just the way things are. I wouldn't have a long career at the firm. I'd be seen as a troublemaker. I'd be seen as rocking the boat. And as many stories as I was hearing, I was also hearing the reasons why they'd been kept quiet. Perhaps I was overreacting. I didn't think anybody would believe me. I thought that maybe I'd be held to blame for what had happened. And I felt like I was seeing this map almost rolling out with these incidents connecting the dots. And I started using the word sexism to describe them. I said, I feel like this is people being treated differently because of their sex, or discriminated against because of their sex. I think this is sexism. And when I used that word, I came up against a real brick wall, particularly from men who said, sexism doesn't exist anymore. Women are equal now. And also, crucially, he often said, go and look at what women are dealing with elsewhere. Look at women in other countries. You don't know how lucky you have it. If you really want to make a fuss about something, go and look at women elsewhere. And I thought that was really interesting, that they decided that we couldn't talk about this. And there was clearly a direct link between the idea that women were equal now and that we were making a fuss about nothing. We were overreacting. We needed to learn to take a compliment. We needed to cheer up. We got the wrong end of the stick. We'd taken it the wrong way. It was meant as a joke. We just needed to learn to smile. And I didn't know very much, as we're all so used to hearing. And I didn't know very much about it. So I thought I'd look into it. I thought, you know, perhaps they were right and actually things were broadly okay. And I started looking in the most obvious places. I started by looking into politics and found that actually, even after our most recent election, just 191 of our 650 MPs is female. That's fewer than a third of our politicians who are female in the House of Commons. And it means that there are more male MPs serving currently than there have ever been female MPs in all of history. In the House of Lords, women are only around a fifth of members. And of course, these are people making decisions that impact on the rest of our lives on a daily basis. And this is something that's also true in the case of the law, in terms of those decisions and their impact, where you find that actually only 7 out of 38 Lord Justices of Appeal and 18 out of 108 High Court judges are women. And in terms of people in positions of power and control, there are over 3 times more men named John running FTSE 100 companies than all the women in those positions in the UK, which is a fairly shocking statistic. But I knew that if I went back to the people who told me women are equal now, there's no problem with these statistics, They would tell me, okay, fine, perhaps men are outnumbering women in business and politics. Maybe men are more likely to go into those fields. Maybe men are stronger in those fields. There'll be other areas where women are dominating. Things will even out as long as there's equality of opportunity. So I thought I would look into the areas that those people might most stereotypically associate with women or being more feminine fields. And I thought the arts was a fairly safe bet for that. And I found that actually, in our National Gallery, out of 2,300 works, it was reported in 2010 that the collection had paintings by just 10 women, that it's been over 14 years since a female choreographer was commissioned to create a piece for the main stage at our Royal Opera House, and that out of 573 listed statues around the UK commemorating people of inspiration and interest, just 15% of them are of women, and just one is of a named black woman. And this continued everywhere I looked. I found that women are fewer than 1 in 10 of our engineers, which is less than half the proportion in France or Spain, that the Royal Society, one of our most important scientific institutions, has never had a female president, and just 6% of its fellowship are women, and that women are 50% of chemistry undergraduates, but just 6% of professors. And those stats seemed important to me because they rather dispute that idea that women aren't going into certain areas or they're not as talented in particular areas. Clearly, if there's double the percentage of engineers in France and Spain than we have here who are women, there's something else going on. Clearly, looking at that percentage of chemistry undergraduates who are women, there's something else going on. And this really persisted everywhere I looked. I found that women only write 1/5 of our front page newspaper articles. Again, the media, another area where perhaps you might have assumed that things would be more gender neutral. That 84% of those front page articles, the lens through which we are encouraged to see the world is presented to us, 84% of them are about a male subject or expert. That women only direct around 5% of the 250 biggest films every year. They only take 28% of the speaking roles in those films, but they're 3 times more likely than their male peers to have to take their clothes off on screen. And women are only 1 in 5 UK architects, but 63% of those female architects reports experiencing sexual harassment in the workplace during the course of her career. And then I came to these statistics. To the statistics that there's a phone call to the police every minute about domestic violence, that there's a rape around every 6 to 7 minutes, adding up to over 85,000 women raped every year and 400,000 sexually assaulted in England and Wales alone. Here, in this country, where people were telling me, don't make a fuss because women are equal now, look at what's going on elsewhere, look at what women are dealing with elsewhere in the world. Here, in England and Wales, over 2 women per week on average are killed by a current or former partner, and a woman has a 1 in 4 chance of becoming a victim of domestic violence and a 1 in 5 chance of being the victim of a sexual offence. So I felt like the argument that we shouldn't make a fuss about it because women are equal now really doesn't stand up to scrutiny. But I also felt that there was very little point setting out to try and solve a problem if people didn't acknowledge that the problem existed in the first place. It's difficult to go out and rail against something if people don't even think that it's there. What I hoped to do was perhaps to try and provide a first step, some way of raising awareness and getting people to recognize the problem in order to then be able to say, well, perhaps now we can start to tackle it. And I felt like the best way to do that would be for people to have the experience I'd had of hearing all those other women's stories together, which helps you to recognize the scale of the problem, the severity of the problem, and makes it so very difficult to write off those stories and say, oh, she must have been overreacting or she should have taken it as a joke, because it's much more difficult to say that when here are 10,000 other women with the same story too. But I didn't imagine that 10,000 other women would come forward. I hoped that perhaps 50 or 60 would share their stories, and I would have something to point to next time I had these kinds of arguments. And what actually happened took me completely by surprise. A few stories trickled in on the first day, and then those few stories turned into 30 or 40, and gradually over time they started to build up and to build up. And within 3 years, we'd received over 100,000 stories from people all over the world. And the stories came from everywhere. They came from a woman in the Church of England, a reverend, who was constantly just being asked if there was a man available to perform the wedding or the funeral ceremony. A woman in the city who was told to sit on her boss's lap if she wanted her Christmas bonus. A woman working in a video store who found that when she went up to the storeroom to get fresh stock up the ladder, her boss would spank her. A man who was congratulated for babysitting his own children. a midwife who was regularly sexually assaulted by a senior male colleague, a vet who was told that there was a particular racehorse that she wasn't allowed to touch because only the male vets were allowed to tend to it. And then gradually the stories started coming in from further afield. They came from a woman in Argentina who tried to ignore four men catcalling her from their car, only to find that they screeched to a halt and tried to drag her in. From a woman in Mexico who was told by her university professor, "Calladita te ves más bonita," you look prettier when you shut up. From a woman in India who was too afraid to report the man with the erection pressed into her back on the bus. From 12 and 16-year-old sisters who were trying to picnic in a public park in France when a man came and exposed himself to them. A woman in Germany who said that she had her crotch and bottom groped so frequently, she simply described it as normal. And what was very interesting, very powerful about the sheer deluge of stories that came in was that suddenly, unexpectedly, here was this largest collection of its kind that had ever been done of grassroots testimonies of this kind of raw data. And it meant that beyond anything I'd imagined when I first started the project, we were able to start pulling out from this mass of anecdotal evidence some really clear trends and lessons and repetitions that came up again and again and again. And it meant that there were certain lessons that could be learned about the nature of the problem and about different ways to solve it. And every time it was about connections. It was about the connections between the different entries that we were receiving. And so, for example, you could see so clearly the connections between some of the more minor things that we're often told not to make a fuss about. We can talk about rape and domestic violence because they're considered valid problems, but if you try and talk about street harassment, then you're often brushed off and told that you're making a fuss about nothing, or media sexism, page three, that kind of thing. But if you look at these stories, you see that the same words and phrases, the same derogatory slurs about women that might be shouted at a woman in the street, just street harassment, just banter, that those same ways of describing women come up again in the story of a woman experiencing domestic abuse or one who's being illegally discriminated against in the workplace. Or you see how one kind of entry, one kind of harassment or abuse very quickly morphs and turns into another. How a woman who tries to reject or ignore street harassment finds that it escalates, becomes abusive, that she's followed home and sexually assaulted on her own doorstep. You start to recognize that we don't live our lives in these neat pockets of separate issues in the way that we like to try and divide them out. That the kind of ideas and attitudes towards women that we encounter in the newspapers that we read, in what we hear as we walk down the street, influence our own ideas and attitudes about women in all areas of our lives. And so that it didn't make sense to say to people, when you walk down the street, actually, a woman in that zone is just slightly a second-class citizen, and it's acceptable for men to essentially make comments about her body and to see her body as public property and to say what they think about it outwardly and out loud, that there's a kind of power hierarchy there. But when you walk through this doorway into your office, suddenly there you're expected to see women entirely as equals and not to see them or treat them in that way at all. But we don't live our lives in that way. And of course that doesn't mean drawing massive lines between everything and assuming a direct connection. It doesn't mean suggesting that somebody looks at page three or hears a wolf whistle and goes out and commits an assault. But it means looking at this in a more nuanced way, looking at the context, at the wider grassroots, normalized attitudes and behaviors towards women that perhaps provide the fertile ground from which others' more serious offenses are more easily able to spring. Or the idea of looking at the way in which we talk about sexual offenses, the way in which we blame rape victims in our public discourse, connects to the fact that only 15% ever feel able to come forward and report what's happened to them, or to the fact that we have a massive problem in jury rooms with myths around victim blaming preventing prosecutions. And so that was a very important kind of connection that came out between the different entries. And the second kind of connection, the kind of lesson that came out very clearly, was that we weren't just hearing stories from women who were experiencing sexism. We were experiencing also stories from people who were experiencing sexism, certainly, but also other forms of prejudice. And again, that these weren't happening in a neatly compartmentalized and separated way. So we were hearing from people who were experiencing sexism, but it was combined with and intersecting with and interwoven with racism or Islamophobia or homophobia. So we would hear, for example, from a woman, a disabled woman, who'd been asked in the street to do a pole dance around her walking stick. when I talk about that intersection, that's the kind of thing I mean, something that is at the same time both ableist and sexist. We heard from an Asian woman who was on campus with her university boyfriend when a man shouted at him asking if she was a mail order bride. We heard from a black woman who was in a job interview when the interviewer cut her off and started talking about his fantasies of sleeping with what he described as spicy and exotic black women. We heard from women who were out with their female partners when men would chase them down the street asking if they could videotape them or join in. From trans women who were hounded from public bathrooms. From women who were experiencing sexual harassment and Islamophobic abuse combined. From older women who again and again used the word invisible in their project entries. One said, "Have you ever wondered why you see so many elderly women wearing bright coats? It's because we're afraid that people will walk into us." And what that, I think, showed quite clearly was about the nature of the problem, the fact that these things weren't experienced separately, that on one day someone didn't go down the street and experience homophobia and on a different day sexism, but that they were having an intersecting impact, and that therefore the way that we approached the problem and that the solutions that we tried to devise had to also be intersectional, that they had to look at these different forms of prejudice and try and tackle them at the same time in order to be effective. And in practical terms, what I mean by that is that if we're looking at a project to try and tackle the gender pay gap, it's not useful for everyone unless it has built in from the very beginning tackling the issue that actually women of colour are earning a lot less than white women. Or that if we're looking at measures to try and take on that statistic I mentioned earlier that one in four women experiences domestic violence, they can only be fully effective if from the beginning they take into account and actively have measures built in to deal with the fact that that figure rises to one in two for disabled women. And so that was the second really clear connection and lesson that came out of these stories that we received. The third was between the stories that we were receiving from women and girls and those from men and boys, which again suggested that it wasn't as simple as two very separate and distinct problems. This is what women are dealing with over here, and this is men's problems over here. Because actually, we'd hear from a little girl who'd been kicked off the football pitch at school and told, "Football's not for you," by the boys, and a boy who wanted to take art or drama or dance GCSE and was being bullied at school because he was told that that was too girly. Well, we heard almost in the same week from a woman who'd been told that she wouldn't be considered for a promotion because she was considered a maternity risk, and a man who'd asked for parental leave, extended time off to spend with a new baby, and had not only been denied it by his workplace, but had really been quite ridiculed for asking for it. And so it became quite clear that often these things were two sides of the same coin, that the same outdated negative gender stereotype was having an impact and a negative impact on both men and women. And that didn't mean to say that this is a gender-neutral problem. It doesn't mean to suggest for a second that the impact is the same. This is an issue that massively disproportionately impacts on women, and I mean that in terms of its severity, its frequency, and its context. Structurally as well, in the world around us, politically, professionally, economically, women are structurally disadvantaged by gender inequality. They also bear the brunt of sexual violence. But it became clear that there are many ways in which these things also disadvantage men, and that this was everybody's fight, that this wasn't about men against women, as the media so often likes to pit us. It wasn't the battle of the sexes or gender wars that makes a kind of sexy slogan for a TV show or a radio debate. That actually this wasn't about men against women. It wasn't about vilifying all men as suggesting that all women are cowering victims. It was about people standing up against prejudice. And part of the reason for that was because actually the stories that we were receiving also made it clear that this was never always a simple case of one person doing something to another person. So very often people would be sending in examples of the kind of thing that is embedded in the structure of the world around us and the way that we live our lives. Things like seeing a headline in one of our biggest newspapers in the business section that describes a scenario in which an extremely powerful and qualified man has got a new job. And the fact that it's not until you put them side by side that you start to notice that there's something different going on in the very same newspaper when the identical scenario is reported on, but the person getting the new job is a woman. That there's something just slightly different about the way that that's portrayed. Sometimes it's the kind of thing that you might click onto or pass by and you feel like there's something going on, but you can't quite put your finger on it. It just takes you a minute to realise that perhaps there's one or perhaps more than one issue going on there. And it's also about, for example, the way that women are portrayed in the world around us. The fact that we see thousands and thousands of women's bodies. We've probably seen hundreds of them just today on our way here, on an advert on the tube, coming up the escalator on the side of the wall, on a bus going past us, on a billboard, flicking through a magazine, on the side of the sandwich carton in Boots. But although actually we see thousands of women's bodies, so it's very easy to feel like we know exactly what women's bodies are like, what they look like, what they should look like, we've actually just seen one woman's body 1,000 times. She's not a woman who looks very much like the vast majority of the general population. She's almost always very young, extremely thin, white-skinned, large-breasted, long-legged, long-haired, very glamorous, very made up. And the impact that we were hearing that was starting to have on people about their ideas about women or their ideas about themselves, particularly young women. But also the way that this impacts when we're not just seeing these women's bodies because they're an actress or a model, but when we're seeing pieces of women's bodies being taken out of context, being dehumanized, being literally objectified, perhaps even just without their head because just their breasts are necessary, being used to sell a completely unrelated product from a burger to a betting website. And the kind of impact that starts to have when the only plausible reason to include part of a woman's body in that picture is to send the message, this is there for the taking. This is consumable. This is something that you want. This is something that you can have. But there's no other reason to connect a woman's body to that scenario at all. And it's also, of course, about the way that we see women being treated and the normalization of that treatment in the public eye. So it's about the way in which any woman who we're hearing about in the media, regardless of the reason why she's actually in the media in the first place, we often hear about her through a lens of, is she sexy and do men want to have sex with her? Is she attractive? This is something that we see regardless of whether somebody is actually in the press because they've been accused of committing a crime, like here where they were having a phone-in debate on a television show about whether or not you'd have sex with Amanda Knox, or also if they're a victim of a crime like Reeva Steenkamp pictured here on the front page of The Sun the morning after she'd been shot dead, or if there are politicians who also repeatedly find themselves being treated in this way, despite the fact that it bears absolutely no relevance whatsoever to their capacity to do their job. These are just a few examples of the ways in which Nicola Sturgeon was portrayed during her election campaign. And of course, again, this is about the wider ripple effect. It's about how these things fit together. It's about going back to the idea that only 191 of our 650 MPs is women, about thinking about who's voting these women in, about what we hear about them as voters. When women are promoted to the cabinet alongside male colleagues and we see articles describing their male colleagues' policies and voting records, and we hear about the catwalk of the Downing Street cuties, what the women were wearing, what their breasts looked like, what kind of makeup they had on. And it's also about the way that women are treated online. This is what happened the first time I ever gave a speech about politics, and it really took me by surprise at the time in 2012, before online abuse was a hot topic and something that lots of people were talking about. And I think that, again, this is a really good example of something which has a much wider ripple effect than perhaps we're aware of in our current conversations surrounding it. These kind of messages started coming in within a couple of weeks of starting the project. They came in sometimes at a rate of up to 200 a day. And it is something that I don't know any woman working in this area talking about these issues or really even voicing an opinion online who hasn't experienced. But there is a very different reaction depending on who's experiencing this kind of thing. And actually, we're seeing very few isolated cases, usually involving very privileged white middle-class women in positions of power, where the media takes interest, and so social media companies feel that they have to listen. But that has very little impact or support for, say, a young woman, a teenage girl, who perhaps voices an opinion about politics on a blog and finds that she's told that she'll be raped. I think that it's very unlikely that she'll feel that she really wants to go back and state her opinion again. It's very little help for a woman of colour who's experiencing racism and sexist abuse on Twitter, who's just receiving notifications back saying this doesn't violate our policies when she tries to report it. This is an enormous problem that we haven't got to grips with yet. And I mention it in the context of this wider kind of backdrop of sexual abuse and sexual violence and sexism, because I think it has an impact on our discourse, an impact on who feels able to access certain spaces, who feels able to share their opinion. And that's particularly important in an age where we have a generation of young people who are accused of being politically disengaged and apathetic, but in reality are feeling alienated by mainstream politics and are carrying out their political activity online, that Facebook and Tumblr and Snapchat and Twitter and WhatsApp are where they're going to have political debates and to state their opinions and therefore to learn how to argue, how to construct an argument or a point of view, how to defend it. And that if we remove young people, if we remove women from those spaces because we're creating spaces so hostile to them, we're also removing them from an entire skill set, from an entire arena. And I think we'll start to feel the impact of that later on. But this is bringing me on from online abuse and the online world to talk about a little bit more specifically young women and what they're experiencing. I've been spending a lot of time in schools and universities, and one of the things that has really struck me is the extent to which young women are facing a real bombardment of pressures and of different issues that aren't necessarily fully visible within the wider outside world. It ranges from the hypersexualization of their bodies in the media, the pressure around sexting, issues around sexual violence, which disproportionately affects young women, even though we often think of it as a middle-aged women's issue, issues around sexual coercion, issues around online abuse. And we're seeing this spill out from our schools, where it isn't being addressed, into our universities. And so in just the past few years alone, this is a small selection of the cases that have hit the headlines. We all know that those cases that end up actually hitting the headlines tend to be the tip of the iceberg. And you can see that there's a really common repeated theme going on here, that we're seeing boys going out in casual rape t-shirts, rugby clubs playing drinking games called It's Not Rape If. We're seeing students being taught necrophiliac chants in their Freshers' Week. We're seeing a Cardiff Metropolitan University poster advertising a Freshers' Week event with a picture of a T-shirt that said, "Last night I was raping a woman and she cried." A Leeds Violation Freshers' Club Night advertised with a YouTube video online that discussed raping a fresher. The homophobic and sexist leaflets that were handed out at LSE, and so on. And I think that what we're seeing here is making it very clear that these are not isolated incidents. And we know this because there isn't just anecdotal evidence alone. We know that this ties into a wider problem around sexual violence on campus. We know from the NUS Hidden Marks study that 1 in 7 female students experienced a serious physical or sexual assault during their time at university, that 12% were stalked and 68% were victims of harassment. We know from that study that the majority of perpetrators were fellow students. We also know that just 10% of those who were seriously sexually assaulted felt able to report it to the police, and only 4% felt able to report it to their institution. So we know that we are failing students on this. We know that we are failing them on sexual violence. And we also know that this is melding in with and connected to a backdrop of this kind of thing being discussed online in a way that normalizes and diminishes it. The next few slides are graphic, so please feel free to look away if you feel that you need to. But I think it's important that we confront and address the reality of the kind of thing that's circulating online, the kind of thing that's being spread around in the name of banter, in the ironic cloak of banter, in the name of humour, that often has the word lad attached to it in some way, the kind of thing that you might come across on your Twitter or your Tumblr or your Facebook feed, not because you've sought it out, but because somebody else has liked or shared it, the kind of thing that's often racking up thousands of likes and shares and comments. And again, this is not to suggest that there's a direct link between the two, but more to suggest what does this do in terms of normalization, in terms of a society that doesn't take these things seriously, and particularly in terms of sending that message to victims and to perpetrators that this isn't something that will be taken seriously. And particularly online, this is something that is targeted at male students. This word lad, the idea of kind of lad pages, confessions of a uni student, spotted university pages, pages that often purport to be about banter and fun, but in reality tend to end up being a kind of underworld of sexual shaming of female students, often anonymously, but sometimes not anonymously. pages which have hosted articles in the past saying things like 85% of rape cases go unreported. That seems to be fairly good odds. And the wider problem that this has in the context of the other things that we know are impacting on young people online. So I think that we can't discuss this really without mentioning online pornography. And we know that young people are exposed to it. We know that 25% of people are 12 years or younger when they first see online porn, and that 60% have seen it by age 14. So we know that this is widespread, that the majority of children have seen it by age 14. We also know that the kind of porn that is currently readily available, the kind of mainstream porn that you might find as a curious 12 or 13-year-old if you literally just typed the word porn into Google and clicked on the top link that came up, is often extremely aggressive. It's often violent. It's often extremely misogynistic. It shows women being hurt, humiliated, and degraded. It's extremely racist. It racializes women into categories. It often focuses on brutalizing women, on very, very young women. And we know that this is having an impact because you'll go into schools and you'll hear from a kid who says, I'm 13 years old and I'm so scared to have sex. I cry nearly every night because a boy showed me a video on his mobile phone and I didn't realize that when you have sex, the woman has to be hurting and crying. I was in another school recently where they'd had a rape case involving a 14-year-old boy, and a teacher had said to him, why didn't you stop when she was crying? And he'd looked straight back at her and said, because it's normal for girls to cry during sex. And this is enormously confusing for young people if it happens in a vacuum and there's no other information being given to them about sex, about what healthy relationships might look like, about signs of abuse, about sexual consent on the most basic informative level, about their rights to their own body. But we know that they are often not getting that information. In fact, a very recent survey found that 75% never learned anything about consent at school. Another survey found that 40% of young people said their sex education was bad or very bad, and 43% said they never received any at all. We also know from the Terence Higgins Trust that 95% of young people learn nothing about LGBT rights and relationships at school. 97% never learn about gender identity. And so you go into schools and you meet young people who are so confused, who are feeling completely ignored, completely erased, who are subsequently dealing with feelings of self-doubt or self-hatred, because even when there is a narrative there, they are written out of it altogether. And so you can start to see how these things all connect. They're all linked together. None of them directly leads one to the other. Each one of them on their own might be manageable, but together they're creating a kind of perfect storm. And this lack of sex and relationships education slightly sits at the middle of it, because it means that young people are bombarded with all these different things, but are never really being given the tools in any way to analyze, to deal with it, or to navigate any of these situations. So what do the solutions look like? Well, clearly, sex and relationships education, compulsory, high-quality sex and relationships education in every school is the highest priority. It doesn't mean teaching five-year-olds about porn, as the front page of the Daily Mail might have us believe. It means talking to kids in a sensible, age-appropriate way, in just the same way that we would say to a three- or four-year-old, actually, you don't hit another child, that we can also teach young people about their rights to their body and respecting one another's bodies from a very young age and build up from there. But it's also about thinking outside the box. It's not just about teaching kids about these issues, because actually 1 hour of really good quality compulsory sex education doesn't go very far on a Tuesday afternoon if you walk down the corridor on Thursday and a boy puts his hand up a girl's skirt and a teacher says, oh, it's just boys being boys, or why aren't you wearing a longer skirt? That actually it has to be within the context of a whole school approach, of better training and support and funding for these issues, of leadership, of dealing with safeguarding in schools and tackling the epidemic of sexual violence that's affecting young people in schools. And when I say that, I don't think that I'm exaggerating. We know from a recent BBC Freedom of Information request that there were 5,500 sexual offences, including 600 rapes, reported to police as having occurred in UK schools in the last 3 years. Now, if you divide that up by the number of days in the average school term, that is almost exactly one rape per school day being reported as occurring in a school. And we all know how very low reporting rates are, not only in the general population, but even more so within the student population. But it's also about thinking even more widely about the box, about the curriculum, about whether or not all of the texts that we're learning about in English literature are written by old white men, about whether we're hearing about a diverse variety of voices and speakers in politics or history curricula. It's about different ways of tackling the problem, and it has to be done creatively. And of course, that's a lot to put on schools. But with enough funding and support, not only would the teacher training be in place, but there'd also be the opportunity to use external organisations, if necessary, to provide some of this support. And there are really great outside organisations doing really good work. One of the biggest problems with this not being tackled at school, going on to manifest itself in the problems that we're currently seeing at university, not really being tackled there either, is that people, of course, then take it with them out into the world of work. And instances from women in the workplace make up the single largest category of entries that we've received at Everyday Sexism, which I think is quite shocking when you stop to think about how common street harassment is. That the most common thing we actually hear about is experiences from within the workplace. And interestingly, it's also often the hardest area to convince people that the problem exists, because people like to think that the Equality Act is in place. People like to think there's legislation. People like to think surely that couldn't possibly go on anymore. And ironically, those kind of attitudes often drive the problem underground. But of course, there are also particular problems within the workplace. So one of the problems is that this isn't appreciated as the diverse issue that it is. When we talk about workplace sexual harassment, perhaps we just think of a sexist joke being made in the workplace. But in reality, it manifests itself in so many different ways. Whether it's inappropriate or illegal interview questions about family plans or about childcare, whether it's sexist comments being made that aren't necessarily directed at the person in question but create a derogatory working atmosphere for her, whether it's inappropriate comments and questions about somebody's sex life, whether it's walking into a meeting with somebody who holds out their hand to your white male colleague and assumes that he's the one in charge and directs all of their questions at him when actually you're the boss. Whether it's the woman who walked into a meeting where she was due to present to the head office and had one of her male colleagues who she hadn't met before turn around and ask her for coffee with milk and two sugars. Of course, it also manifests itself in sexual harassment and in a fairly shockingly high level of sexual assault, sexual offences happening in the workplace. We did a big piece of research on this in association with the TUC that came out in August. And we found that 1 in 8 women had experienced either unwanted sexual touching or attempts to kiss them while they were at work, things that could be defined as sexual assault under UK law. And it's also something that happens in terms of indirect discrimination, subconscious discrimination within the workplace. So, for example, perhaps you've heard about the survey that was reported in the journal PNAS, the study, where they sent out identical CVs for science jobs, but half of the CVs had male names on them and half of them had female names. And when they came back, overwhelmingly people were more likely to hire the male candidate, they were more likely to give the male candidate a higher starting salary, and more likely to offer them to personally have mentoring. And we know that this is an intersectional issue as well, so very similar studies have done with white-sounding and non-white-sounding names and have come back with really similar results. So we know that this is something that is happening on multiple levels. And of course, another one of those levels is around maternity. And again, this is much more complex than we perhaps like to think. It isn't just about somebody having their employment terminated because they become pregnant. It might be about somebody not being hired in the first place because they're seen as a maternity risk. It might be about that impacting someone's career progression, regardless of whether they actually plan to or are able to have children at all. Or it might be a woman who has had children but comes back to the workplace raring to go and is told that she's been just sidelined onto a different account because, you know, it will be helpful for her because her mind will be with her baby. Or she's asked if she has baby brain, or she's accused of having leaky boobs. Or it might be the woman who was going off on her honeymoon on her extended leave, whose boss gave her a wrapped gift in front of the office, but when she unwrapped it, she found that it was a jumbo box of condoms, and he told her, to much laughter from her colleagues, not to go and get pregnant. It's something that can have a major impact, and again, it's not just anecdotal. So we know from the most recent Equality and Human Rights Commission data that 54,000 women every year lose their jobs as a direct result of maternity discrimination. We know that only 3% of those ever take a case to tribunal, and we know that there are now more barriers than ever in the way of women who do seek justice in that way, since the last government brought in tribunal fees of up to £1,200 up front. Since those tribunal fees came in, the number of claims being made has plummeted by 80%. But the argument made was that it would be weeding out spurious claims, those women who were just chancing their luck, who were just trying it on with an invalid claim. And if that were true, of course, we'd have expected to have seen a sharp corresponding uptick in the success rate of claims. In fact, there's been very little uptick whatsoever. So we know that this is something that's having a major impact. But we also know that it isn't just about the impact that it has on victims and survivors. We also know that it actually has a fairly dire impact on workplaces and organisations themselves. And what that means is that tackling the problem is actually good for business. Again and again and again, studies by the major management consultancy firms suggest that increasing equality and diversity has a really, really big positive impact in terms of returns, in terms of customer retention, in terms of staff retention, in terms of outcomes for the company as a whole. We also know at a kind of lower level that when women experience low-level regular sexism or sexual harassment, often when reporting is too difficult, we deal with it in different ways. We adopt coping mechanisms. We find ways to get round it. We start walking home with our keys between our fingers. We go to the bathroom in packs. We text each other to let one another know that we're home safely. We change our route to avoid street harassment. And in the same way, women in the workplace might start avoiding a particular situation where they might interact with a certain colleague. They may just start putting themselves forward a little bit less. They may take increasing numbers of sick days. They may end up having to take time off because of subsequent mental health problems. We know that this has a massive impact in terms of productivity, in terms of workplace morale, and then for all of these different reasons that it has an impact on overall company performance. So it makes sense to deal with the problem, whether you look at this from a moral standpoint or an economic one. So how do we do it? How do we solve the problem in the workplace? Well, I think that you have to start by saying that this really goes back to the roots that we've already discussed earlier, that actually, in many ways, implementing compulsory sex and relationships education, even though we keep banging on about it, really will have a ripple effect for many of these different areas. But we also know that there is a huge amount that can be done now, that can be done by businesses, by government, by organisations. We know that there are issues like tribunal fees that are standing in the way of women accessing justice. We know that there are other legal issues that the government could address, like the fact that the third-party harassment has been repealed. So it used to be an employer's responsibility to protect an employee if they were being harassed by a client while they were at work. So, for example, a waitress being harassed by somebody that they were serving and so on. But because that's been repealed, women are left with far less protection in the workplace. So there's specific issues like that where we could call on government to deal with these issues. We could also call on companies and businesses to look at their policies on issues like flexible working hours, shared parental leave, childcare, things that have a very real impact on women's participation in the workforce. But we also know that sexual harassment in the workplace goes enormously underreported because people don't think they'll be believed, because people are worried about the negative impact it will have on their career, because they don't know how to report, because it's not clear what they can report, or because the person they would normally report to is the person in control of them, their line manager, in control of their career, the person doing the harassing. And so it's also possible for companies to have a massive impact on this, not only by looking at tackling the problem, by openly discussing it, starting a conversation, by implementing sexual harassment training, unconscious bias training, but also by taking a really careful look at their sexual harassment policies, their reporting procedures, whether there's something built in there to make sure that those who report don't face recriminations as a result. And this is also something that everybody can play a part in. So we've talked about some of the high-level organisational government solutions, some of the things that major issues that could be put in place. But the good news and the frustrating news is that there is no one single silver bullet. There is no one big policy change or one single law that will change all of this and make it okay. In many of these situations, what we're seeing is already illegal. So the policy shift has happened, the campaigning has happened, but it isn't necessarily trickling down to impact on women's experiences on the ground. And what that really comes down to is attitudes and behaviours, what we consider normal, the standard that we walk past being the standard that we accept. And in many ways, that's very frustrating because it's much harder to tackle. It's much harder to change something intangible like that than it is to tackle these big, clear campaigning issues. But on the other hand, it's very exciting because it means that the power to change it is with us. And I think that there are some real similarities in this area to climate change. Bear with me. Not only because activists who work in the area of climate change and the environment often have to contend with media debates that suggest that this is a completely equal issue and get somebody on to argue against them, which is very similar to the way that women's rights are often depicted in the media, but more because it won't work if we don't all do it together. It isn't possible to make the difference that we need to see if 5% of the population fastidiously recycle every separate thing and everybody else shrugs their shoulders and throws their milk carton in the bin. It has to be a group effort. It has to be. And the same is true here in terms of these normalized attitudes, because we learn about what's considered acceptable from the responses of those around us. Because the man on the bus that day very, very clearly learned from the response that he got from my fellow passengers that this was something okay, that he could carry on, that he could go and do it again, that he could tell his friends. And that's how we change this, by responding, by reacting when we see it. It doesn't have to mean waving a banner and going on a march unless that's what you want to do, but it will cross each of our paths at some point. Even if we don't go out looking for it, it will be something that each of us will see. And we will have that moment of opportunity, whether it's in communication with the people in our lives when these issues come up, whether it's in the way that we talk to children in our lives, whether it's being the cool aunt who buys a chemistry set for their niece and a toy cooker for their nephew, whether it's being somebody in the workplace who notices a conversation going on that's discriminatory and actually points it out when it would be much easier to look the other way, whether it's being somebody in your particular field who does something to disrupt the status quo, being the picture editor who chooses not to illustrate every article with a picture of a woman's legs, whether it's being the person who sees a woman walking down the street being harassed and chooses to say something, chooses to respond, or chooses perhaps to support her, not necessarily to confront the perpetrator if it's not safe to do so in that situation, but makes the point that this isn't normal, that I'm not just going to walk past. And it doesn't have to be something very scary and formal. It is something that can manifest itself in many, many different ways. And I'm going to leave you with an example of that. And it's a silly example, really. It's an online example. But for me, it really epitomizes the fact that when these kind of interventions happen, their efficacy is almost completely determined by the reaction of others. If one person tries to stand up to something on their own, particularly if that person is the target of the particular form of discrimination, it's very, very difficult for them to do that. But if other people, if witnesses and bystanders and those nearby are the ones who stand up, and crucially, if more people support them, then very quickly that power dynamic of what's considered normal, of who's on the side of the majority, shifts. And this is a really good example of that happening when a sporting Twitter account sent out this sexist tweet before a big game asking women to send photographs of their breasts. And one woman decided to challenge it. She decided, actually, I am going to send them a picture of my tits. And she did. And there was a horrible knife-edge moment where it really could have gone either way. And some of the followers of this account started responding really quite nastily and really sending her quite nasty, misogynistic, abusive responses. But what happened next was that other people joined in. Someone sent them a pair of jugs. And someone else saw it and thought, actually, I'm going to add my support here as well, and decided to send them some nice baps. And after that, things really started to pick up and they got a massive rack. People started to get quite creative and they got a lovely muff as well. They were also at one point sent some big bazookas and even a cute little ass. And I know it's a silly example, but it completely changed the tone of that conversation, of that moment, of that online interaction. And to anybody that was involved in it or witnessing it, it sent a really clear message about where the majority were, about the general feeling of what the tone was and what the tenor of what was acceptable within that online space was. And it made a real difference. And so I think it's about thinking of those moments, which every one of us will have, when it would be much easier to be the person who doesn't stand up, but we all have to decide, will I be the person who says something or the person who looks out the window? Thank you.
So I think you can tell by the applause that that was a really fantastic lecture by Laura Bates. So we now have half an hour in which it's possible for you to ask questions and get some response. We have some travelling mics. So if you want to ask a question, if you could just put up your hand and I'll get the mic to you, and just say who you are and try and keep your questions kind of, you know, to the point, so that as many people get a chance to speak as possible. So who wants to start? Yes, so in the middle there of the fifth row back. Yeah.
Thank you for that. That was amazing. You just said, like, so many things that I've been thinking throughout, like, my life. Like, it was amazing. Thanks so much. I know you picked up on this as well around, like intersectionality is being fundamentally important to all of this. And also, like, I want to bring, highlight the connection with mental health as well within that as well. And how, I actually forgot my point because I'm nervous. Oh, nervous, yeah.
It's okay, take
like, for myself, for example, that was it. So I have various mental health disabilities because of my natural responses to gender depression and violence. And what I wanted to bring in is isn't it like funny, as it were, that my experiences are considered disabilities and considered problems, and when actually it's very much a reasonable responses to unreasonable circumstances, and how the people that inflicted that violence and oppression, that's not considered a mental health issue on them, it's considered normal and normalized. And yeah, I just was thinking that as you were saying, and yeah, thanks. Okay.
Thanks very much.
Can you hear me? I think that's an amazing point. Thank you for sharing it with us. That's such a brilliant way of looking at it and flipping the script. And I think that particularly that intersection of misogyny and mental health is so complex because it encompasses elements of sexual violence, of coercion and emotional abuse and victim blaming, but also elements of the access to mental health care. And I don't know, perhaps people who follow Everyday Sexism on Twitter, yesterday was World Mental Health Day, and we had a Twitter chat where people were sharing their experiences of that intersection of mental health and misogyny. And what was really striking was the number of women who, for a variety of intersecting reasons, had struggled to get access to healthcare they needed, whether they were old women who were dismissed as menopausal, whether they were younger women who were told you'll feel better if you just get a boyfriend, whether they were black women who found that the angry black woman stereotype prevented them from being able to speak about what they needed and access the support that they needed. Just a huge range of different stories. So if anybody is interested in that area, our timeline from yesterday has a really powerful conversation on it, and also some really good self-care strategies and links which might be really helpful as well. But thank you for sharing that really powerful thought.
Okay, so the next person is three rows from the back in the middle. And again, yes, so it's it's you. So again, just say who you are when you get the mic and ask your question.
Hello. Again, thank you very much for coming to speak this evening. It was really powerful. I have a question about your practical strategies. In terms of school interventions, it seems like quite a not easy exactly, but it's quite manageable in terms of it's an institution, there's a clear structure, there's a clear sort of head of school area where you can get into and target. But in terms of universities, they're a bit of a beast. You've got so much going on, you've got so many different strands, you've got so many different threads. Is this something that universities, do you think, either of you, are committed to changing? And if so, what are their strategies for doing that? Are they throwing resources at it? Are they prioritising it? Is it something that people really care about, or is it lip service?
I think that's such a good question, and you're right to identify that as a major problem. I think I would say that there are areas of really fantastic practice at university. There are specific staff members and specific departments where we are seeing this being really prioritised and people who are really trying to focus on tackling it. I know, for example, that Durham University is about to release a document outlining its strategy for how it deals with these issues. I haven't seen that document yet, but I know, you know, that some universities are taking it very seriously. But my impression from the feedback that I've received from the Everyday Sexism testimonies and also from visiting universities up and down the country is that this is still an issue that isn't dealt with well, that it's still something that universities and schools would prefer to sweep under the carpet, to minimise, to pretend isn't happening, to protect their reputation rather than to protect their female students and give them the support that they need when it happens. One example of that was one of the examples on that slide of university issues around sexual violence was the infamous lads on the bus tape that emerged at Stirling University, where a YouTube video went viral of a filmed on a mobile phone, a group of boys in the hockey team at that university on a public bus chanting about miscarriage and sexual assault. And when I visited Stirling University to give a talk, three young women approached me afterwards and said, can you help us? Because we put that video up online. We wanted to start a conversation about the reality of our experiences and what we're facing on a day-to-day basis. And as far as we know, the boys involved haven't faced any disciplinary action yet, but we've been threatened with suspension for bringing the university into disrepute. So I think that issue was resolved after we brought some national press attention to bear on it. But clearly, this is not an issue that is being dealt with universally. What I would say is that the National Union of Students has for some years now been doing really, really good work on this. What they've argued for a long time is that the Zelic guidelines, which is the document around sexual violence and how universities deal with it, are completely inadequate and unfit for purpose, and that we need a standardised national framework for how universities have to respond to sexual violence, specifically around investigation, around supporting students. Many of you might have seen the recent case of a professor who was allowed to continue teaching at a university after having viciously physically assaulted a student and so on. So I think that it'll be interesting to follow that Zelic consultation, which I think is coming out in the next month or so, and the NUS work on that, which has been really, really powerful. I think we have to continue to push on this. This is one area where we're really several steps behind the US. They haven't solved the problem of sexual violence on campus, but they've put it on the map. They've recognised it. They've quantified it. And that's partly because of incredible work by survivors and student activists who have organised and supported one another, but also because they had a president who was prepared to put it front and centre and really push the agenda around it. So I think we need to see similar support here from the top, but there has to be buy-in from universities. And at the moment, there isn't, not at the top. It's often downplayed. And I think perhaps what that might look like is a standardised model in a similar way to the Title IX things that are happening at US universities, where universities are realising that they have no choice but to tackle the problem properly. And I think we need to see moving in that direction here as well.
And I suppose just to add that obviously our hope is that the Equity, Diversity and Inclusion Task Force at LSE is precisely going to be able to develop some more effective action around this. There was somebody just in the row behind you. Yes, there.
Thank you so much for your really comprehensive talk. It was really interesting. I'm Carmony. I'm a former student here at LSE in the Gender Institute. And my question is about how do we find the balance between representing diversity in terms of gender, race, sexuality, class, and making individuals feel like tokens, or society looking at it as a non-meritocracy-based way of hiring people? Thank you.
I think that's a good question. I think we have to normalize it. I think the basic answer is we have to normalize it to such an extent that these aren't seen as one-off tokenistic instances. I think that mainstreaming an equality and diversity lens across the board, whether it's in politics, in business, so that it is a normal and accepted measure that we're taking into account all the time, is the best way to do that. But I also think that there are such clear arguments against the idea that this is unfair or that this is tokenistic. I think that one of the most powerful arguments in favour of quotas for me is how ridiculous the arguments against them are. When you talk about positive action, you hear people saying, most commonly you get this massive backlash of, but it wouldn't be fair because then the best people wouldn't be getting the job. Broadly speaking, that is what the main response is. And in order to make that argument, you genuinely have to believe, statistically, that there are three times more men named John qualified to be leaders of FTSE 100 companies than all the women in the country. You would have had to believe in our last government that, just purely statistically again, that there are more men who happen to go to school with our Prime Minister who are good enough to be in the cabinet than all the women in the whole country. I mean, it just doesn't add up. It's just completely ridiculous. And I think that partly it's about adopting that approach, that this isn't about helping out poor, you know, people who aren't quite performing well enough on their own who need a leg up. It's about taking action to overcome systemic inequality. It's not about the playing field being like this at the moment and some people are getting an unfair leg up. It's about recognizing that an unofficial system of discrimination has been in place for years and years and years on the basis of all those characteristics that you mentioned and more, and that this is about leveling the playing field in a way that isn't being achieved in other ways. So I think that it's partly about representing it in that way, and also about the positives, about not always making it about the person who's getting the job, but about the business or the organization or the political party that is benefiting from being able to choose from an entire workforce instead of just the middle-class, white, male, non-disabled, cisgendered, heterosexual part of that workforce, which, you know, is really kind of narrowing your talent pool. So it really is kind of promoting the fact that this is positive for everybody. It's not about kind of giving an individual a leg up who doesn't deserve it. It is completely different from that. And I guess maybe if we were able to talk about it in that way, it would be useful as well.
Okay. So someone here in the third row at the front. No, sorry. Oh, okay. Well, so first of all, this one here, and then I'll come to the other one afterwards. Yeah.
Thank you so much for that, Laura. I think, as with many people in the audience, so much of what you said is our story, that's your personal story. My question is around, I mean, I've worked in numerous workplaces, and how do you approach it when women actually engage in that low-level sort of sexism? And because women have engaged in it, as a woman, if you try and stand up, you're seen as even more of an outlier, and it's deemed acceptable because other women have contributed to it.
I think it's really difficult. It's really frustrating. It's something that I find incredibly frustrating in my work. It most commonly comes up when you want to do a media debate of some kind and the media will find one other woman who's prepared to say, yeah, that one woman, they found her, and they always could. It's always the same woman as well. It really is. Who's prepared to say, like, oh, actually, women are just making a fuss about nothing and they shouldn't wear short skirts and actually all we want to do is be in the home and we're not interested in careers or whatever it is. And because it's another woman, the media thinks they can put her up with impunity and turn something into a debate that never should have been a debate in the first place. So, yeah, it really does have that dynamic of making it more difficult to speak out. I think what we have to recognise is that this is a very complex issue, and the idea of it not being about men against women is also partly the fact that this is so deeply ingrained, that it's so deeply embedded in the world around us, that it makes sense and is understandable that many women have internalised these sexist issues as well, perhaps simply because of the sheer normalisation, or perhaps because there are reasonable and understandable coping mechanisms to be adopted in a world in which it is much easier to be one of the lads and to go along with that kind of banter and that kind of thing. So I think that we have to tackle it in much the same way as we tackle the sexism that we encounter when it comes from someone who isn't a woman. But I think that it shouldn't mean that we don't feel able to still make those comments and those protests. What I wouldn't necessarily say is that we should automatically expect other women in the workplace to kind of be our champions. I love the idea of women supporting other women, don't get me wrong. I love the idea of mentoring and support, but I sometimes worry that it puts an unfair burden on women to be the ones to solve their own problems. You know, the idea of there's a special place in hell for women who don't support other women, but I think there's a special place in hell for men who don't support women too, and I think that we mustn't let them off the hook. Everyone's going to hell. I think we mustn't let men off the hook by reserving particular vilification for women who behave in a way that is no different from the way that many men are behaving. Unfortunately, I think that much of this is internalized, and this isn't what you've suggested at all, but just since it's linked, I'll just also want to bring in the fact that you quite often come up against people trying to really blame women for these things, you know, saying, women are the worst enemies, women hate other women's success, or things like, well, you complain about women's magazines, but they're written by women and women are buying them, so... Or women who are accusing particular pop stars of being the problem, being the real problem because of the way that they dress in their music videos. And I think all that is fascinating because we bring women into a world where literally from before they're born, they are being stereotyped, where we know that girls from the age of 5 worry about their body shape from the All-Party Parliamentary Group report on body image. We know from that report that 25% of 7-year-old girls has dieted to lose weight. We know that 80% of 10-year-old girls has dieted. We know that the number one magic wish of teenage girls is to be thinner, out of all the things that girls have to wish for. We bring girls up in this world where everything around them tells them your body is really what you are. Whether or not men want to have sex with you is really how your value is measured. No matter how much you hear that beauty's on the inside and you can be whatever you want to be, you know. And then when they're presented with a manual that tells them how to achieve that body or how to look that way that they have been told over and over again is the real value that they should be aspiring to, we go hit them over the head with it and go, silly women, shouldn't have brought it on yourself, didn't you? I just think it's ridiculous sometimes the kind of spiral through which we view things. Or indeed for us to create an industry completely powered by and controlled by men in which women are made to feel that this is a particular way in which they have to sell themselves and sell their music and then to blame them for it, instead of saying, hang on, there's something wider going on here, because if this was a spontaneous choice, we'd be seeing equal numbers of men naked in their videos and we're not, so there's something gendered. So I think it's frustrating and complex and ultimately shouldn't stop us from speaking out, but I also don't think that it's cause to then necessarily vilify those women any more so than we would men acting in the same way.
Sorry, in the second row here.
Thank you very much for a very interesting and powerful talk. I'm actually a former student here and staff member, I guess, so it's nice to be back. So my question, I guess, is sort of simple and sort of complex. And it's sort of about why is all of this happening? Do you think we are seeing a rise in sexism and sexual assault and all of this exclusion, or is this just a long path that has continued? So any thoughts on that would be great. Thank you.
Well, I don't think that there's a single simple answer to that. I certainly think that this isn't new. I mean, I certainly think that this is an enormous, ancient, age-old historical problem. I think that it's a global problem. I think that in many ways, perhaps we're seeing a gradually increasing willingness to discuss it and to acknowledge it and talk about it, and that perhaps that's progress. Cautiously, I would say that is progress, although it's not progress alone unless it actually leads to change and action. But I would say that there are elements of the problem that are new. I think that obviously issues around modern technology in particular are brand new. Online abuse is brand new. That the impact of online pornography just hasn't been fully appreciated or explored, and that we have opportunities to offset it, to mitigate it, to handle it, to support young people, and we're missing those opportunities. It's interesting that we will never again be in a situation where there is quite such a gulf between the experiences of young people and the generation in charge of them, as it were, because by the time the next generation has children, it will be digital natives bringing up digital natives. And at the moment, there is this achingly sad, I think, comprehension gap. There is nothing worse than seeing a Conservative MP stand up in the House of Commons and say, we can't have sex education because teen pregnancy rates will go up. It's just so frustrating to hear that lack of awareness of what young people are dealing with. And you see it all the time. I was doing a talk a couple of weeks ago, actually, and the organizer came into the green room and said, I've noticed that there's a woman here with her 8-year-old daughter. And I was talking about my book, Girl Up, which deals with sexting and online abuse and all kinds of issues around that, but also career and mental health and body image. And they said, we've seen your pictures and we just feel like some of the issues you're tackling are probably a little bit too old for her. We're just going to give the mum a heads up about some of the stuff you're talking about. And they came back a few minutes later and said, oh, she says she knows exactly what you're talking about. She's come on purpose to introduce her daughter to these issues. And I was like, yeah. But then at the end, this 8-year-old girl came up with her book to be signed. And she said, this has been really helpful because I got my first unwanted dick pic a year ago. And it was like the perfect example of how we think we're protecting kids. We think that we're doing the right thing by saying, oh, I don't want to expose them to that, but they're already exposed. There was a 14-year-old girl at my book signing last night, and she came up and said, I just want to let you know that I'm 14, and in the last year I've been asked for naked pictures 10 times, and the most recent was on Thursday. And it's just, I think that there is definitely something new there, and I don't think that we're dealing with it. But I don't think that necessarily means that everything is terrible and we're going backwards, although I do think we're also seeing an odd kind of revival of retrosexism. Mm-hmm. So we're hearing a lot about girls who put their hand up in school being told, get back in the kitchen or make me a sandwich, which feels like something very old-fashioned that's kind of coming back again. And I'm interested in this idea that there's a kind of backlash. I'm not sure that I fully subscribe to that. The full answer is that I don't know exactly, but I think it's probably more complex than being able to say either that things are getting worse or that they're the same and we're just hearing about them more. I think it's probably a combination of both. But this isn't completely related, but it just reminds me really powerfully of the story when Rashida Manjoo, the UN Special Rapporteur on Sexual Violence, came to the UK. I don't know if anyone remembers this. And she said that the UK was the most sexist country she'd recently visited. And I think part of the problem is that when we do get the data on these issues, when we do actually have a report, we then completely dismiss it and ignore it. So I was about to suggest to you that it would be a really good idea for someone to do some really good, like, quantitative research on this, but actually what happened in that case when she did come and say this was that as soon as she left, the media went mad. So there was a Telegraph article that was published by a white man that started with the line, Rashida Manjoo could not be more wrong. Genuinely. And I had all these interviews, these radio interviewers ringing me up and asking me to come on and discuss it. And as soon as I went on, the line of questioning every time was, tell us, you know, this is ridiculous. I mean, it's not, the UK is not more sexist than other countries, is it? Like, you know, look at other countries, like, this is absolute nonsense, isn't it? It's not true. And I had to say, I don't know. I don't have the answer to that because my work's predominantly focused in this country. We have branches in other countries, but they're relatively in their infancy, so I don't yet have the data to be able to say. If only there was an international expert whose job was to go around the world and report on sexual violence, whose opinion we could ask. So I think part of the problem is that even when we have the answers, we don't listen. But I think more research would be helpful.
Okay, so three rows from the back at the side there, yes. Oh, yes, three rows from the front, I mean.
Hello, I'm Zoe. I'm also a former student here, but in the government department. This is a slightly different question, so apologies. But I'm a massive advocate of using my consumer money and leisure time to support sort of female projects and female books, TV, whatever. So I was wondering if, aside from your own, both of you, aside from your own books, whether you have something in pop culture, whether it's TV, podcast, book, that you could sort of recommend?
Wow. Oh, my gosh.
Oh, right.
That's such a good question. So many things, and my mind is immediately going blank. what would I say? Well, first of all, I think it's a great thing to do, and I definitely agree. And we haven't even touched really on capitalism and the massive impact and overlap that there is there. Like, there's a whole range of stuff around. I didn't mean that as a criticism of you. I mean, like, generally that idea of kind of consumer power and being aware of it and what we can do with it. There is an amazing new magazine called Galdem. I don't know if anyone's heard of it. It's incredible. They've just brought out their first print issue. It's by young women of colour. It's amazing. It's really fantastic. I would recommend it hugely. What else? There are really fantastic, I don't know if this is so much about cultural consumption as about kind of support of groups, but in that same spirit, some really fantastic organizations around doing great things in this area. And I think STEMETS is a really great example of that. Look them up, they're amazing, they're absolutely brilliant. What else? If anyone hasn't read We Should All Be Feminists, amazing, definitely like a brilliant, brilliant one, brilliant book to read, go to. Yeah, those are some starters.
Okay, over here, please.
Thank you. Very interesting talk and support all other comments. So I am trying at the work at the moment to introduce a diversity and inclusion policy. And one of the things I'm struggling with, perhaps similarly to looking at the audience tonight, is how do you engage men in that conversation? So working with a senior leadership team of predominantly men, how do you ensure that actually they're as bought into this, the importance of this, as the women who I think inevitably naturally already are?
I think that's such a good question. I've been starting to do a bit more work with organisations and businesses and companies recently, and one of the things that I've really seen is the kind of different approaches and the fact that there can be this real sense of please come in and do a talk, and then it's just all the women in the room who already know all of this and none of the men. I went to one very big, well-known consultancy company where it was all the junior women who were brought in and then one senior man who was basically their boss. And at the end of the talk, he was the first one with his hand up and he said, you know, this is all very well, but, you know, can I just say you're obviously cherry-picking the worst cases and, you know, I just want to ask, have any of the women in the room here, please put your hand up and tell me... Have any of you experienced anything like this? And there was this horrible moment where obviously none of them needed to feel any pressure to disclose and it could have just been awful. And then every single woman in the room put her hand out and he literally just sat down. So I think that it can be a real problem and that there are real kind of risks around that kind of initiative, because if it's done in the wrong way, then it gives an organisation an opportunity to have a kind of tick box of being able to perform doing something for diversity, when actually if it's a women's network that doesn't get support and isn't integrated within the wider kind of policies and that kind of thing, then it's essentially putting the labour for dealing with this problem onto already probably overworked and under-promoted women. So I think for me the main thing is working out ways to make sure that it is much wider than that, whether that means making it mandatory, making it something that involves lectures, training, something that everybody has to do, that it's not something that's just self-selecting, because automatically the people who choose to come along to this kind of thing or to do that kind of thing are probably those who least actually need to hear it in terms of not knowing about this stuff already. I think buy-in from the top is completely crucial. So having support from leadership level and having them make it very clear more widely within the company, within company culture, within the workplace, that this is something that's being taken seriously from the top is one of the greatest indicators of success, according to some of those studies about equality and diversity. So getting leadership on board is really important. And I think trying to find ways to mainstream it, so by which I mean not having a single initiative that does one thing, but having an initiative that focuses on trying to get this on the agenda for everything that's being considered or being done within the workplace, is also really successful if you can. So I guess it depends on the kind of workplace, but really trying to infiltrate all levels with this approach. So a little bit like at school, where I was talking about like it being about the curriculum and whether you're only having white male speakers, as well as something like sex and relationships education. I think that kind of wider integration is really key. And finally, I think what happens in client-facing situations, I don't know if this is relevant to your particular organisation, but one of the things that I see as a real pitfall is workplaces who address this in-house and don't address the problem of client sexual harassment. And I think that that's a very, very important one, because you'll often see workplaces being quite well-meaning to a point, but then when it involves clients, there's a real sense of hands-off, please the client, just deal with it, put up with it, keep quiet. And so I think that that's an area where really strong policies are needed in order to make sure that it's taken really seriously.
Thanks very much. So I'm conscious that we're now pretty much at 8 o'clock. So I think, in fairness to Laura, we have to bring the questions to an end. There will, as I said at the beginning, there will be an opportunity to buy the books, and Laura is willing to sign them straight away after this, just in the just outside the entrance. So can I just ask you just to join with me in thanking Laura for a really...